Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. Yesterday we had a record-breaking day. I think it's the most we've ever had. 624 downloads. 624 people listening to my stupid voice in a 24-hour period. That's pretty cool. Thanks for listening. Today, we're reading Book 15, Chapter 14. It would be difficult to explain why and where two ants, whose heap has been destroyed, are hurrying. Some from the heap, dragging bits of rubbish, eggs, and corpses. Others back to the heap. Why they jostle, overtake one another, and fight. And it would be equally difficult to explain what caused the Russians, after the departure of the French, to throng to the place that had formerly been Moscow. But when we watch the ants round their ruined heap, the tenacity, energy, and the immense number of the delving insects prove that despite the destruction of the heap, something indestructible, which, though intangible, is the real strength of the colony, still exists. And similarly, though in Moscow, in the month of October, there was no government and no churches, shrines, riches, or houses, it was still the Moscow it had been in August. All was destroyed, except something intangible yet powerful and indestructible. The motives of those who thronged from all sides to Moscow after it had been cleared of the enemy were most diverse and personal, and at first, for the most part, savage and brutal. One motive only they all had in common, a desire to get the place that had been called Moscow, to apply their activities there. Within a week, Moscow already had 15,000 inhabitants, in a fortnight 25,000, and so on. By the autumn of 1813, the number, ever increasing and increasing, exceeded what it had been in 1812. The first Russians to enter Moscow were the Cossacks of Wintzingerode's detachment, peasants from the adjacent villages, and residents who had fled from Moscow and had been hiding in its vicinity. The Russians who entered Moscow, finding it plundered it in their turn. They continued what the French had begun. Trains of peasant carts came to Moscow to carry off to the villages what had been abandoned in the ruined houses and the streets. The Cossacks carried off what they could to their camps, and the householders seized all they could find in other houses and moved it to their own, pretending that it was their property. But the first plunderers were followed by a second and a third contingent, and with increasing numbers, plundering became more and more difficult and assumed more definite forms. The French found Moscow abandoned, but with all the organizations of regular life, with diverse branches of commerce and craftsmanship and luxury and governmental and religious institutions. These forms were lifeless, but still existed. There were bazaars, shops, warehouses, market stalls, granaries, and for the most part, still stocked with goods, and there were factories and workshops, palaces, and wealthy houses filled with luxuries, hospitals, prisons, government offices, churches, and cathedrals. The longer the French remained, the more these forms of town life perished, until finally all was merged into one confused, lifeless scene of plunder. The more the plundering by the French continued, the more both the wealth of Moscow and the strength of its plunderers was destroyed. But plundering by the Russians, with which the reoccupation of the city began, had an opposite effect. The longer it continued, and the greater the number of people taking part in it, the more rapidly was the wealth of the city and its regular life restored. Besides the plunderers, very various people, some drawn by curiosity, some by official duties, some by self-interest, house owners, clergy, Officials of all kinds, tradesmen, artisans, and peasants streamed into Moscow as blood flows to the heart. Within a week, the peasants who came with empty carts to carry off plunder were stopped by the authorities and made to cart the corpses out of the town. Other peasants, having heard of their comrades' discomfiture, came to town bringing rye, oats, and hay, and beat down one another's prices to below what they had been in former days. Gangs of carpenters, hoping for high pay, arrived in Moscow every day, and on all sides logs were being hewn, new houses built, and old charred ones repaired. Tradesmen began trading in booths. Cookshops and taverns were opened in partially burned houses. The clergy resumed the services in many of the churches that had not been burnt. Donors contributed church property that had been stolen. Government clerks set up their baize-covered tables and their pigeonholes of documents in small rooms. The higher authorities and the police organized the distribution of goods left behind by the French. The owners of houses in which had been left much property brought there from other houses complained of the injustice of taking everything to the faceted palace in the Kremlin. Others insisted that as the French had gathered things from different houses into this or that house, it would be unfair to allow its owner to keep all that was found there. They abused the police and bribed them, made out estimates at 10 times their value for government stores that had perished in the fire, and demanded relief. And Count Rostopchin wrote proclamations. Alright, there we go, another chapter down. And we're rebuilding Moscow. Just like that. And it's kind of this mess, messy, unscripted ordeal, isn't it? There's no orders being given, there's no big plan of attack, it's just kind of falling back together. Everyone's flocking back to Moscow, and somehow it's working. People are cooperating and doing what needs to be done. Kind of cool. It was interesting to see that just regular old commerce was a driving force in the rebuilding of Moscow. You'd think after a country is devastated by war that the rebuilding of a city would be like volunteer type stuff. And it was. I mean, a lot of people were just volunteering to help. But I don't know, you don't think of it as like people trading and carpenters moving there to get a good price on building, rebuilding. And, you know, people setting up food shops to sell food to all these people that are flocking back to the city to work on building the city. And, yeah, it's just commerce. Peasants came in with oats and grains and hay and were bartering down the prices to the lowest ever price. Interesting to see. You kind of think it would all just be like aid work and volunteer work and army or military effort to rebuild, but no. Turtle Vader said, "Why is it that a greater number of people gather in Moscow after the French leave than were present to begin with?" Good question. I think they're just flocking back to do what needs to be done, I suppose. It's just like the war's over and everyone is aware of the fact that they need to rebuild, and Moscow is the obvious place that needs attention. So they're flocking there. It's probably also a bit of like a, like in the aftermath of a war, you'd be thinking like, how do you wind down from that? Like you need a bit of a sort of debrief session. And there's maybe a bit of like, Moscow seems the place to go for that. That's where everyone's meeting up. Turtle Vader also said, "Does this inspiring story of the rebuilding of Moscow seem possible in modern times?" The dystopian stories we find so common among contemporary sources paints a different picture, but I tend to be optimistic. Sure, I think it would be very possible, probably look a lot different, but, I mean, the power structures are all different and that kind of thing, but sure, I mean, I think we see that with natural disasters. There were some pretty cool photos and stuff after Japan had those earthquakes about, when was that? 10 years ago? Close, no, 8 years ago? Something like that. 2012? But anyway, whenever that was. There was these photos of the roads being completely crumpled up and broken, and then a few weeks later, they're all smoothed back, and they've gone and they've fixed all the roads up, and they just rebuilt, and they just did it so effectively, so efficiently. It was amazing. Too Clever by 8715 said, Count Rostopchin and his ridiculous proclamations. That's how we know life in Moscow is truly back to normal. Ha. Huh. Yeah. Count Rostopchin wrote his proclamations, was the last line of the chapter. Things are back to normal. Or at least they're getting there. Alright, I think I'll leave it there for this chapter. Pretty short one, not much to comment on. Thank you very much for listening. See you tomorrow.